everyone. If you grab your donuts, grab your top up, grab a seat. Right, this morning I'm going to carry on this series that we started 2 weeks ago on the book of Daniel. Before we do that though, in case I haven't met you before, I'm Alex. I'm part of the staff team here. I'm one of the pastors. I look after, as Neil said, the youth and some of the things that happen up at the community centre, the yard. And it's a massive privilege to be able to come and speak today about Daniel. I'm continuing the series that, as I said, we started 2 weeks ago. So today I'm going to look at chapters 2 and 3. But before I do, let's pray. Lord, I thank you for your presence. I thank you that you speak to us today. You enable us to worship with you. I thank you that you soften hearts and bring us closer to you. And I just pray that for everyone in here, and everyone in kids and youth, that everyone here leaves today with a greater sense of your love than when they came in. And I pray, Lord, speak through me. I pray you bless this time in Jesus' name. Amen. Okay. Little recap. So who was Daniel? Daniel was a young man living in Jerusalem, and then the Babylonians came in the sort of 6th century before Christ, and they attacked Jerusalem. They destroyed most of the city, including the temple, and they took the strongest and the wisest and some of the younger, those who could have been soldiers, off to Babylon. They exiled them, and they left the remnant back in Jerusalem. And so we find Daniel as one of these people, young man, bright guy, being exiled to Babylon and being trained in the ways of Babylonians in the king's temple, in the king's palace, sorry. And we see him with his friends, Meshach, Shadrach, and Abednego, who we're going to look at today. They come together and they, as we looked at in the first week, they decide not to conform with the Babylonians, but instead allow God to transform their minds and stay loyal to him, and then stand firm in the face of great danger. That's what we looked at in the first week. The second week, the last week, we looked at the problem of sin, which is an under all of these topics, the four we're going to look at, are kind of underlying themes that run through this book. Sin starts the book. It's how the Jews got themselves into Babylon in the first place. They'd sinned greatly against the Lord, and he decided to give them over to the hands of the Babylonians. They attacked Jerusalem, as I said, took a load of people to Babylon because of their sin. And then we see in the rest of the book, these kings like Nebuchadnezzar, Darius, Belshazzar, their sin, their weakness, their negligence, things they do deliberately, creating trauma for those in Babylon. And for Daniel and his friends. So we looked at that last week. And this week, we're going to look at, the title is God is Bigger. And it builds on those previous themes. He's bigger than the sin. He's bigger than the culture around us. So, this question though, of whether God is bigger, comes up even almost before we start reading the book. Because there's a debate. If you look into the kind of theology of this book, there's a debate as to whether it was written 600 years before Jesus was born or 200 years before. And the reason some people think it was written, a lot of people believe it's written 600 years before, because that's what it says. It says it was written in the reign of these particular kings, which is around about that time. But about half of this book is prophecy. It predicts events that happened sort of 300-400 years later, really, really accurately. And a number of theologians take that and say, that's too accurate. It can't have been written beforehand. I mean, there are other arguments for that, some linguistic ones, but the biggest one is, it's just too accurate. And I can understand that perspective, but as I was reading one of the commentaries on this book, this jumped out at me. In the final analysis, the great issue may be one that surfaces in Daniel itself, in the questions. Do we have a God who knows and rules the future? Do we have a God who reveals his secrets to his people? Do we have a God who delivers men from burning furnaces? And that's the question for today. How big is our God? I mean, maybe it was written 200 years before, but nevertheless, he still predicts Christ. He still predicts God's kingdom coming. I believe personally it was written 600 years before. I believe God is big enough to give us this accuracy of prophecy, this revelation. So before we even start, we have this question of God's greatness, of whether, as we read in Ephesians 3, God can do immeasurably more than we can ever ask or imagine. So then we get into the book itself. The book is kind of, as I said last week, if you've been tracking, in two halves. You've got this first half that is essentially historical. It's chronological. You've got Daniel with the different kings. Different things happen. The second half is lots of dreams. It's kind of like the book of Revelation. It's apocalyptic writing. It's looking at what will happen on earth, but what's happening in the heavens to create that. Some of it's confusing. I needed some help understanding it. But it's good and it's rich. And it shows God's greatness. It shows God is bigger than our immediate problems. And God is bigger than the biggest problems that the earth can bring. He has eternity in his hand. So we're going to dive into chapter 2. I'm going to set the scene first. Here's the scene. We've got a despotic, megalomaniac king. Quite like that word. It's quite nice to say. He has a terrifying dream. And he asks the sorcerers and the astrologers to help him understand this dream. But he doesn't make it easy for them. He says to them, tell me what the dream means, but also tell me the dream. That's quite a tall order. He doesn't even tell them what the dream was. He needs them to tell him to make sure that they're legitimate. And he says, if you can't do that, I'm going to have you killed. Again, it's quite a strict regime. And then Daniel swoops in and he says, no. Let me have a go. Don't do anything. I'm going to go and pray with my friends, Meshach, Shadrach, and Abednego, and we're going to pray, and God's going to reveal this. So he goes, he has some time, he goes back with his friends, they pray, God reveals the dream, and he goes back to Nebuchadnezzar and says this. So we're going to dive in at Daniel 2, 31 to 45. No wise man, enchanter, magician, or diviner can explain to the king the mystery he has asked about. But there is a God in heaven who reveals mysteries. He has shown King Nebuchadnezzar what will happen in days to come. Your dream and the visions that passed through your mind as you were lying in bed are these. Your majesty looked, and there before you stood a large statue, an enormous, dazzling statue, awesome in appearance. The head of the statue was made of pure gold, its chest and arms of silver, its belly and thighs of bronze, its legs of iron, its feet partly of iron and partly of baked clay. While you were watching, a rock was cut out, not by human hands. It struck the statue on its feet of iron and clay and smashed them. Then the iron, the clay, the bronze, the silver, and the gold were all broken to pieces and became like chaff on a threshing floor in the summer. The wind swept them away without leaving a trace. But the rock that struck the statue became a huge mountain and filled the whole earth. This was the dream, and now we will interpret it to the king. Your Majesty, you are the King of Kings. The God of heaven has given you dominion and power and might and glory. In your hands he has placed all mankind and the beasts of the field and the birds of the sky. Wherever they live, he has made you ruler over them. You are the head of gold. After you, another kingdom will arise, inferior to yours. Next, a third kingdom, one of bronze, will rule over the whole earth. Finally, there will be a fourth kingdom, strong as iron, for iron breaks and smashes everything. And as iron breaks things to pieces, so it will crush and break all others. Just as you saw the feet and toes were partly of baked clay and partly of iron, so this will be a divided kingdom. Yet it will have some of the strength of iron in it, even if you saw iron mixed with clay. As the toes were partly iron and partly clay, so this kingdom will be partly strong and partly brittle. And just as you saw the iron mixed with baked clay, so the people will be a mixture and will not remain united any more than iron mixes with clay. In the time of those kings, the God of heaven will set up a kingdom that will never be destroyed, nor will it be left to other people, to another people. It will crush all those kingdoms and bring them to an end, but it will itself endure forever. This is the meaning of the vision of the rock cut out of the mountain, not by human hands. A rock that broke the iron, the bronze, the clay, the silver, and the gold to pieces. The great God has shown the king what will take place in the future. The dream is true, and its interpretation trustworthy. Now, I did manage to find a picture of what this might have looked like. And that's an artist's impression of how this would have looked. Pretty grand. Head made of pure gold, chest and arms of silver, belly and thighs of bronze, legs of iron, feet partly of iron and partly of baked clay. And then we've got a next slide. Yep. The rock, not made of human hands, coming down and smashing this to pieces from the bottom. As Daniel said, Babylon, which is Nebuchadnezzar's empire, is the golden head. And then others come, each toppled by the former, by another. Until we get to the bottom, the feet, which is thought to represent the Roman kingdom, Roman Empire. Which is when the rock from heaven comes, Jesus, displacing all of the kingdoms on earth. Now, there are lots of these dreams in this book. Quite symbolic, confusing in many ways, dreams, particularly in the second half. And also, if you look in Revelation, there's similar types of writings. And the dream was showing Nebuchadnezzar that his kingdom wasn't eternal, and he is not God. This dream was to humble Nebuchadnezzar. In Isaiah 40, 22-23, we read, "He sits enthroned, God sits enthroned above the circle of the earth, and its people are like grasshoppers. He stretches out the heavens like a canopy and spreads them out like a tent to live in. He brings princes to naught and reduces the rulers of this world to nothing." And that's what this is about. It's trying to show Nebuchadnezzar what is happening, what's going to happen. It's aimed to humble him so that he would ultimately turn to God. But this whole dream is also giving Daniel confidence that no matter how bad things get, for God's people, for his immediate friends around him, no matter what kingdoms and rulers might come in the future, God is bigger. The dream is telling Daniel and us that God has a plan for now and for all eternity. Even if we can't understand what he's doing, God is bringing all things together for the good of those who love him. Now, for me and my family, some of you might know that the last 2 years haven't been the easiest. And some, particularly in my home group, my amazing home group, know that right now there are people who I hold very dear who are going through particularly heartbreaking things. Things where there's not really an answer that I can see. And I'm not going to stand here and tell you I'm the perfect Christian, always peaceful about these things. You know, I do pray about them. And for these people, not as much as maybe I should, or as much as I'd like. And I'm slightly in awe of people like my wife, who seems to be so steadfast in her prayer and her journaling. Too often, probably, I find myself eating junk food or watching junk TV just to forget, rather than always turning to God. Or sometimes when I do pray about these things, I don't know what words to bring. Or I find myself getting angry at God. Which is why, by the way, I find Psalms like Psalm 88 particularly comforting. It shows that God is bigger than our angriest, messiest prayers. But even in the midst of the mire, in my lowest points, God has given me and he's given us an anchor, the gift of eternity. 1 Corinthians 15 says, "Death, where is your victory? Death, where is your sting?" And this is my anchor. If everything goes wrong, if my worst fears come to pass, I know that Jesus will one day return and restore all things for those who love him. You know, sometimes we get glimpses of God's kingdom now, and we see him step in and change things. We see miracles. We see people healed. But sometimes we don't. And when we don't, let's hold on to God's promise of eternity. And this is what this chapter, I believe, is, and much of the second half of this book is about. Kingdoms will rise and fall. Wonderful and terrible things will happen. But despite it all, God will conquer. He will triumph. The rock in that dream has come. Jesus has come, and he's taken the power. He's taken the sting out of sin and death so that we can hold deep in our heart the hope of eternity. Now, I was listening to a talk the other day forwarded by a friend when the person talked about this picture, this one up here, which at first I didn't see much, I didn't really quite get it. And then in the talk, he unpacked it. If you notice, this is by a guy called Magritte. The artist is looking at an egg, but he's painting a bird. He sees in front of him something pretty mundane, but he's painting the full potential of what that will become. And I believe we too can see with these eyes when we allow God to show us. We might see in front of us heartbreak, really, really hard, difficult situations, but we can hold deep in our heart the full potential of what God will bring when Jesus returns and restores all things. Now, we're going to move to chapter 3 now. These chapters work, I believe, quite beautifully together. So what's happened here is, before I read, we've got Nebuchadnezzar not seeming to have learnt his lesson. So you'd have thought this dream with Daniel unpacking it, showing him the future, trying to show him how great God is and God trying to humble him, he might have listened. And in some ways, when you read the chapter, he expresses a kind of worship to God, but it doesn't seem to have sunk in, because let's read what happens. Chapter 3, verses 6 to 27. Whoever does not fall down and worship will immediately be thrown into a blazing furnace. Therefore, as soon as let me unpack it a little bit further. I didn't go quite far enough. We have Nebuchadnezzar having his dream. Then he builds a statue, not the statue we saw, a statue of pure gold, and he tells everyone they have to bow down and worship, and if they don't, they'll be thrown into a fire, which is where we get this sentence. Whoever does not fall down and worship will immediately be thrown into a blazing furnace. Therefore, as soon as everyone heard the sound of the horn, flute, zither, I'm not sure what that is, lyre, harp, and all kinds of music, all the nations and people of every language fell down and worshipped the image of gold that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. At this time, some astrologers came forward and denounced the Jews. They said to King Nebuchadnezzar, "May the king live forever. Your majesty has issued a decree that everyone who hears the sound of the horn, flute, zither, lyre, harp, pipe, and all kinds of music must fall down and worship the image of God. And that whoever does not fall down and worship will be thrown into a blazing furnace. But there are some Jews who you have set over the affairs of the province of Babylon, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who pay no attention to you, your majesty. They neither serve your gods nor worship the image of gold you've set up." Furious with rage, Nebuchadnezzar summoned Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. So these men were brought before the king, and Nebuchadnezzar said to them, "Is it true, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that you do not serve my gods or worship the image of gold I have set up? Now when you hear the sound of the horn, flute, zither, lyre, harp, pipe, and all kinds of music, if you are ready to fall down and worship the image I made, very good. But if you do not worship it, you'll be thrown immediately into a blazing furnace. Then what God will be able to rescue you from my hand?" Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego replied to him, "King Nebuchadnezzar, we do not need to defend ourselves before you in this matter. If we are thrown into the blazing furnace, the God we serve is able to deliver us from it, and he will deliver us from your majesty's hand. But even if he doesn't, we want you to know, your majesty, that we will not serve your gods or worship the image of gold you have set up." They're saying that God will deliver them, but even if he doesn't, they will still remain faithful because God is greater. Then Nebuchadnezzar was furious with Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and his attitude towards them changed. He ordered the furnace heated 7 times hotter than usual. I don't know how you do that. And commanded some of the strongest soldiers in his army to tie up Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego and throw them into the blazing furnace. So these men, wearing their robes, trousers, turbans, and other clothes, were bound and thrown into the blazing furnace. The king's command was so urgent and the furnace so hot that the flames of the fire killed the soldiers who took up Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And these three men, firmly tied, fell into the furnace. Then King Nebuchadnezzar leapt to his feet in amazement and asked his advisors, "Weren't there three men we tied up and threw into the fire?" They replied, "Certainly, Your Majesty." He said, "Look, I see four men walking in the fire, unbound and unharmed, and the fourth looks like the son of the gods." Nebuchadnezzar then approached the opening of the blazing furnace and shouted, "Shadrach, Meshach, Abednego, servants of the Most High, come out, come here." So Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego came out of the fire, and the satraps, prefects, governors, and royal advisors crowded round them. They saw that the fire had not harmed their bodies, nor was there a hair of their head singed. Their robes were not scorched, and there was no smell of fire on them. Now, we've seen God give Nebuchadnezzar this long, eternal perspective of his kingdom, of God's kingdom. And now we get an amazing example of God's kingdom breaking into the here and now. We sung earlier about heaven touching earth. It's one of those moments. We see God's power, God's miracle. You know, he builds this huge statue. Really, he should have built the statue that God showed him in the dream if he was going to be faithful to God. But he built one. He asked everyone to worship. And we see a fourth man in the fire. Now, many people would say, is that Jesus? Maybe it is. I believe it probably was. And that, along with the fact they clearly weren't hurt, that must have been incredible. I mean, it still wasn't quite enough to change Nebuchadnezzar's heart, if you listen to last week's talk, which is actually the next chapter, but wasn't quite enough. He had to have another dream, but it gets him pretty close. And those around, you'd hope that they may have started believing in the living God. But you look at the words of Meshach, Shadrach, and Abednego, King Nebuchadnezzar, "We do not defend ourselves before you in this matter. If we are thrown into the blazing furnace, the God we serve is able to deliver us from it, and he will deliver us from your majesty's hand. But even if he doesn't, we want you to know, your majesty, that we will not serve your gods or worship the image of gold you've set up." You see, they knew that God holds eternity in his hands. They had faith for the future. They had faith in God's love, in his majesty. And because of that, they could have faith for now. They could have faith for a miracle now. I'm going to show you a slide of a guy. If we get the next one. This guy, right? His name's Arthur Stace. Now, he lived in Sydney. He was born in the 1800s and lived, this picture was taken around about 1930. He was an alcoholic. He went to church. A preacher, he says in his memoir, persuaded him to stop the alcohol and turn to Jesus, which he did. And so he got some chalk and he wanted to persuade other people to follow God. So he wrote on the page, like writing on the pavement, "Follow God." But in his words, he said, "Oh, follow God wasn't so good. So I started writing eternity instead. That's much better." And he did, eternity, all over the pavements. And it's famous now in Sydney. There's a plaque up. Even they lit up Sydney Harbour Bridge with the word eternity, because he's so famous there for just going around Sydney writing eternity. And when you read his memoir, he said it was simply because it makes people think. Makes people think about things that aren't in front of them right now, about the bird instead of the egg. You know, when we have faith in eternity, I believe we can have faith for God to show up now. This is what Meshach, Shadrach, and Abednego showed us in their faith to go into the fiery furnace. You know, God does show up now. God, heaven does touch earth now. In the Bible, we see miracles, big and small. We see water turn into wine. We see blind people regaining their sight. We see people healed. We see huge miracles like the feeding of the 5,000 with just a few loaves and fish. We see people raised from the dead. We see Jesus himself dying and rising to save us all from the power of sin and death. We see miracles big and small. And when we have eyes to see, we see miracles big and small now. You know, several years ago, a friend of mine had cancer. And she was told she would never have a second child because of the extensive scarring and tissue damage from the surgery and all the treatment. But then several months later, she went back to the surgeon. who examined her. And this surgeon said they'd never seen anything like it. The scarring had gone completely. The surgeon apparently used the word miracle. He simply could not explain it. It was as if apparently, and again, these were his words, it's as if there had been no cancer there at all. And so a year or so later, she gave birth to a beautiful boy who's now 11. Now that, I believe, is a huge miracle from the words not only of someone who believes in Jesus, but from a surgeon who couldn't believe their eyes. And more recently, you know, there's been miracles we've seen in our home group. We spent quite a long time, I love my home group, but for a while there, it was often just me and lots of ladies. So we prayed for some men, and within about 3 months, we got to a point the other week where it was 50-50, I think last week just gone. And this happened really quickly. God brought some amazing men. That, to me, out of nowhere, is a small miracle. We've been praying for people to have jobs, 3 people in particular in our group. All of them now have jobs. Again, you know, you could say, oh, well, you know, that would have happened anyway. I'm going to believe that's a small miracle. God is the God of eternity and the God of miracles now. And we don't see them all the time. But I think that's kind of the point. These moments of God's kingdom breaking out give us glimpses of something so much bigger. God's eternal kingdom. His rule and reign will one day overcome all the darkest and the strongest powers of this earth. It's the same glimpse Daniel and Nebuchadnezzar got in the dream in chapter 2. And it's the knowledge of God's love and greatness that gave Meshach, Shadrach, and Abednego the faith that would protect them from the flames. We worship an awesome, majestic, beautiful God. God, our Father in heaven, can do immeasurably more than we can ever ask or imagine. So in a minute, we're going to pray for miracles. We're going to pray for one another. And let's hold deep in our hearts the sure knowledge that God has already defeated sin and death. You know, when we put our faith in Jesus, there is hope for now and there is hope for eternity. We're going to go into some ministry time now. And I'm going to invite the Spirit of God to come. And I'm going to invite people to come up. Any and all who would like prayer. If you would like prayer for...